You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Find out where The Takeaway is playing in your area by going to thetakeaway.org/stations.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Ah, yes, music to speed over ice and snow to Russian music. It's Prokofiev there. We're going to use the opportunity of the opening ceremonies at the 2014 Winter Olympics, just one day away, to preview some very different and very current Russian pop music. We're also going to pull the curtain this hour on the dramatic history of Sochi and the lands of the Caucasus with a historian who says the luge event is the perfect metaphor for the headlong violence and spirited history of the region. We're also going to give you more than one reason to move to the state of Tennessee, a state that takes innovation very seriously in education and in building a better internet. But safety is the question looming over those Sochi games right now. Earlier this week, Matthew Olson, director of the National Counterterrorism Center, testified before the House Intelligence Committee.
The primary threat from a terrorism perspective comes from Imrat Kavkaz, probably the most prominent terrorist group in Russia. It's made its intent clear to seek to carry out attacks in the run-up to the games. We think the greater danger from a terrorist perspective is in the potential for attacks to occur outside of the actual venues for the games themselves in the area surrounding Sochi or outside of Sochi in the region. But we are sharing information with the Russians. They are sharing information with us. There's always more we could do in that regard. But as of right now, I would characterize that the level of sharing as good.
At those hearings, Congressman Mike Thompson popped the big question.
Do you know of any specific threats targeting the Olympics?
There are a number of specific threats of varying degrees of credibility that we're tracking. This is what we expected. It's what we saw in the run-up to prior Olympic Games and prior events like these.
That was basically a yes from Matthew Olson. Another lawmaker, Representative Bill Keating, Democrat from Massachusetts, may be closer to this situation than most. He was part of a congressional delegation that returned from Sochi late last month. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Keating shared some of his concerns directly with you.
He did. Keating is a freshman from Massachusetts and on the Foreign Relations Committee. John, he popped up in Sochi a couple of weeks ago with Mike McCall, chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. They weren't invited. They just kind of turned up and said they surprised the Russians. You know, he's from Massachusetts, and I asked him if some of the cooperation between the FBI and Russian security from the Boston bombing last spring has actually helped in this regard. I was a little bit surprised by what he said.
It's really walled off. I found out that, yes, the cooperation continues on matters surrounding the Boston bombing. Beyond that wall of that investigation, that the cooperation is not newly expanded between the U.S. and Russia.
So it's not helping us with security in terms of our interest in security in Sochi.
The Boston cooperation between the two countries has not particularly extended to anything beyond that. And the reason is because Putin and the President, President Obama, talked personally. They personally agreed to cooperate. And so when Putin will tell his FSB, you cooperate concerning the Boston bombing, it's very top-down. They will do that. He didn't tell them to extend that cooperation beyond it, and they haven't.
Well, Keating says there's not sharing, but of course Matthew Olson told the House Committee on Select Intelligence on Tuesday that he would characterize the level of sharing as good. Those are sort of irreconcilable statements there.
Well, Keating says that there is sharing. He just said that some of the cooperation that had come out of the investigation of Boston hadn't really led to a increased level of investigation or more camaraderie or professional exchanges as he expected in Sochi. And that was interesting. John, when we were kind of done with the interview, he turned to me and he said, oh, and by the way, nobody should take an iPhone. And I turned on my recorder again, and I said, well, why not? Why not take an iPhone to the games?
I've been telling people if they can do this, leave their iPhone, leave their iPad home. If they want a telephone, just try and get something that inexpensive that they can take. And because they will be, there's much more invasiveness there. The security there will be penetrating people's iPhones. They'll be monitoring social conversation. And that level of privacy that exists in the U.S. is not there. In Russia.
A lot of people will listen to that comment and view it with a sense of irony given what we've learned about our own surveillance in this country. But the point is taken. You say it's even more invasive there.
That same sense of irony exists when Snowden, who was so concerned about these issues, now resides in Russia, where they have the most invasive attacks on people's privacies that you could ever imagine.
It's Congressman Bill Keating, a Democrat from Massachusetts. You know, someone described it as like one of those airport security scanners, that when you walk into one of those scanners, except in Sochi, the entire city is going to be like one of those scanners in terms of its invasiveness.
Concentric rings of security. They call them the rings of steel, going out from the venues and outward. And then again, in the mountain regions where the skiing events and the bobsled events are taking place, he said he went to both of those and again surprised the Russians when he was there. John Keating has some perspective on what's going on with the separatists in Dagestan and in the Caucasus and with Vladimir Putin. You know, we've heard some reports in the last couple of days that security officials are even warning that there might be attacks on airplanes with chemicals in toothpaste tubes. It's all getting quite specific. And Keating had something to say about Putin's role in all this.
This is President Putin's moment. His personal thumbprint is on this event. Because of that, provide the terrorists the opportunity for them to get on the world stage and show that they've done things to hurt Putin, who they consider an enemy.
Which brings us back to, you know, Matthew Olson, director of the National Counterterrorism Center. In a sense, Putin could succeed in keeping the security tight in Sochi, but fail if there is an attack elsewhere in Russia.
And that's part of the concern. We saw dual attacks in Volgograd some month ago, of course, John, and there's an acceptance beyond the rings of steel that you can't secure the entire country. And that's, of course, a big part of the concern.
The challenge we'll be watching all through these games, in addition to the athletics and the great competition. Todd Zwillich, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
When you hear what sounds like a great idea, you want to share it. When you see a community working together to achieve a worthy goal, it can be infectious. When you hear it is some government initiative, we may all be a little conditioned to be skeptical. But the state of Tennessee wants the world to know they're not waiting for anyone. Not anyone in the gridlocked federal government or the often stingy, short-term thinking private sector. They're going to make a bold play to improve education in their state on their own. This week, Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam announced a plan, the Tennessee Promise, to make the state's 13 community colleges and dozens of vocational schools essentially free. No tuition, no fees. The change, which requires state legislative approval, looks like a political winner in the volunteer state. Joining us now is someone who would be directly affected by this tuition-free plan, Dr. Janice Gillum, president of Northeast State Community College. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
As the president of one of the community colleges in Tennessee, does it thrill you that the government wants to make all tuition free, or does that, you know, suddenly strike at your business model a little bit?
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. It's a truly historic day for community colleges in Tennessee. And the state has a reserve of the lottery funds that they're going to put away into an endowment, pending legislation approval. So it's very exciting.
Do you think this will get approved?
It appears so, and we're anxiously awaiting.
All right, so let's talk about this from the educational policy standpoint. I mean, on one level, the governor is being very, very innovative. But there's also an argument to be made that he's basically just recognizing the fact that the community college system has been backstopping the inadequacies in the public school system for decades, and he's just basically incorporating the community colleges into the public schools.
You could say that, but basically we're working together, the public schools and the community colleges. Northeast State was one of the first colleges to integrate the Bridge math course, which was our revised lab-based, mastery-based, competency-based version of developmental math, and we have now taken that to the high schools. And the governor supported us on that initiative as well, $1 million to pay for the books and other materials and access to the internet. So these students can pass their math competencies before they ever leave high school, and that's going to, in itself, make a huge difference as we try to the governor's initiative, Drive to 55, is to take us from 35% of citizens without a college degree or certificate to 55% by 2025. So that's a very bold initiative and kind of started with the Complete College Tennessee Act back in 2010. So we're on a roll. Our public schools have made the most progress of any state and probably the largest jump in history for a public school. So we're all working together, and the governor is leading this effort.
Now, describe for me, as the president of a community college, describe that transition for young people going from a senior in high school to a community college and how you can capitalize on what's going on there.
Well, it's much easier at the community college than a university. They can still stay at home with parents and not have to pay out a lot of expenses for boarding. But we've worked with high school students for years. We have a program called College Access, and our staff helps students transition, whether it be from the GED or the new high school equivalency diploma program or just from high school itself. So there's so many opportunities for our students. Once the light bulb turns on, we had a student just this spring transferred with a full ride to Columbia University, and just it was an outstanding opportunity for her. But I'm a community college graduate myself. I went to Western Carolina and NC State University to get my degree. So we can get you there from Northeast State.
Well, I love your enthusiasm. You really think that's your job, turning on light bulbs in high school students?
Absolutely, and letting them know, giving them confidence. That's the biggest challenge that we face, is giving those students confidence that they can actually do this.
To states around the United States who are listening to you and are looking at the community college system and who might be a little more cynical than you sound, convince us that the community colleges don't really simply amount to a kind of a dumping ground for failures in the public schools, that this is actually an educational engine for providing opportunity in the state.
It absolutely is. And some of our students may complete in 2 years, but most take 3 to 6 years. As myself, I was working full time. I couldn't go to school full time. So I believe strongly that this is a system that works. It takes a little more time for some students, but we are integrating the guided pathway systems, cohorts, structured learning classes, so that students can get on track, provide direction for them to complete, and to coach them and to mentor them through this process. And we believe we're changing lives every day.
On the front lines of what we might call the 21st century economy, Dr. Janice Gillum, president of Northeast State Community College in Blountville, Tennessee. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Got a special invitation if you're in New York next week from The Takeaway. We've lined up a fun and informative evening for anyone who loves codes and code breaking and wants to explore all the codes that are critical in our understanding of science. We have some great guests, some amazing stories about how and why they spend their lives making and breaking the real codes that matter in all of our lives. We've got a bar and a band, nothing to decode there, right here at WNYC and the Green Space in Manhattan. It's on Tuesday evening, and if you want to know much more about it, it's all at thetakeaway.org, including how you can get a ticket.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We've got more evidence that Tennessee could be a model of future innovation and thinking. This state was once a hub for manufacturing and transportation. The railroads of yesteryear have become the FedEx of today. And I haven't even mentioned Nashville's impact on popular culture in America and the world, for that matter. Maybe you should just move to Chattanooga, a city of barely more than 160,000 people. Why? Well, it operates the fastest citywide internet network in the United States. For only $70 a month, you can access a 1 gigabit per second internet speed in every Chattanooga home and business. That's a 50 times faster speed than anywhere in the country. You'd have to move to Hong Kong to get that kind of service. Download a movie in seconds. Upload your just-produced HD music video also in seconds. How did the mid-sized southern city find itself on the frontier of internet technology? What has it meant for a once outdated and struggling economy? This is no Chattanooga choo-choo. It's a bullet train of internet infrastructure. Andy Burke, mayor of Chattanooga, Tennessee, joins us. Mayor, welcome.
Hello, it's great to be here.
How'd you get this up and running? Whose idea was it? How long has it been going?
Well, EPB, which is our local electric utility, decided in the late 2000s to apply for a grant from the Department of Energy related to the stimulus to build out its fiber optic network for the smart grid. Along with the smart grid came this gigabit per second capacity, which we've used over the last several years as it's gotten up and running.
And this is available to all residences and businesses?
We have the fastest, most pervasive, cheapest internet in the country. We're talking about 1 gig per second, and it's $70 per month.
And what can you do? I mean, what can you do from your smartphone? What can you do from your laptop, your computer, your iPad?
Well, you and I both know that you don't need gigabit per second capacity to run Google.com faster. What you do need it for is the things that you were talking about earlier. If you want to do really complicated video uploads and downloads, if you want to test tomorrow's technology today, Chattanooga, Tennessee is the place to do it.
And that's presumably why Drew Beltz, co-founder of Fancy Rhino, a creative agency in Chattanooga specializing in video, web, and design, is pretty happy in Chattanooga. Drew, are you there?
Hey.
And what's the 1 gigabit per second capacity do for you?
Well, you know, it's kind of this uber powerful weapon that we don't actually know how to use yet. It's an amazing moment for us to have this available. As a video production company, we're looking forward to how we'll use it in the coming years. But to, in all honestness, we all don't know how to use it yet. It's so much power.
And that means potentially you'll need to be hiring people to actually fill this capacity to really take advantage of what's an opportunity that, you know, the sky's the limit.
Yeah, and, you know, other cities are going to have to come along for us to really make full use of this with gigabit networks of their own. Because, for instance, in our place right now, it really only means something to people inside of Chattanooga. It's like that scene in Willy Wonka where they send chocolate bars across the room. They get smaller on the other end if there's not the same line happening. So we've got a gigabit here, but we need other people to have it for it to really mean something.
Mayor Burke, how's that going to work, and who would you love to collaborate with to really show the sort of networking capability city to city?
Well, our fiber optic network, to me, is the basic infrastructure that you're going to need to operate over the course of this innovation century. If you think about what highways or railroads were in the 20th century, in the 21st century, it's the technology infrastructure that really matters. I think what you'll see is more partnerships across cities as more places come online with this. Just today, for example, we're launching the Gigabit Community Fund in Chattanooga. That's a partnership with the National Science Foundation and Mozilla to bring $150,000 to Chattanooga just to develop apps that will run our gigabit per second network. We hope to start partnering with people across the country to show how this can really be a generator of economic activity throughout our country.
Now, you got 55 businesses on board, right?
We do. We have people from all across the city who are excited, in particular because it is affordable here.
And the subscription rate, though, for residents, it's really only about 8%. So you've got some work to do there to get the message out.
We do, and I think people understand that they don't necessarily need that gig capacity right now at their residence. But again, for us, it's a matter of changing the conception of ourselves. That's a big part of it. We now think of Chattanooga, Tennessee, a mid-sized southern city, as a place for innovation and creativity. It generates economic activity for us in terms of bringing real jobs. And then it's also a selling point so that as we talk to people who are thinking about locating here or expanding here, they know that they have the infrastructure to run their apps and their computer models for decades to come.
You know, to both of you before we go, do you think that, I mean, it's great to have a competitive advantage, and Chattanooga clearly does for a moment here, but do you think internet service of this scale is like a utility, like the water system, something that should be provided free to enable, you know, activities in cities the size of Chattanooga? Andy and then Drew.
Well, we really have been trying to figure out the best ways to get as many of our citizens as possible on this. One thing that we've got to do is use this to bridge the digital divide, because we know too many Chattanoogans, despite having 600 square miles of gigabit per second capacity, that too many of us don't have true access to it. But on a practical level, we also know that we have this great resource, but that at least for the moment, the way in which it will truly make a difference is for those companies and entrepreneurs who know how to take advantage of it in a way that typical residents like me, who just want to surf the internet on a regular basis, will not.
Drew Belts, final thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's pretty cheap at this point, and we're all pretty excited to begin to experiment with it. Whether or not it needs to be free, I think, will be ours to say in the next few years as we really actually take advantage of it the way we take advantage of other utilities.
Well, you're the laboratory there in Chattanooga. Drew Belts, co-founder of Fancy Rhino, a creative agency specializing in video, web, and design. Andy Burke, the mayor of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, another big discussion going on in America today, where cigarettes should be bought, where they shouldn't be bought, and the continued sort of diminishing of the role of tobacco in America. You know about the CVS decision to stop selling tobacco products. What do you think about it? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Hey, don't mess with tobacco.
In 1910, the U.S. was producing 10 billion cigarettes a year. By 1930, we were up to 123 billion. What happened in between? Three things: a world war, dieting, and movies.
The triumph of marketing and sheer aggression is celebrated in the movie Thank You for Smoking.
Tobacco is winning the war. The war against our children.
Kind of funny, kind of not funny, but that's the movies. The war is over in the United States, and Big Tobacco has lost it seems. When CVS, the biggest drugstore in the country, announced that it plans to stop selling cigarettes in all 7,000 of its stores across the country, it was just one more big sign that thanks but no thanks is the public message about smoking these days. Stanton Glantz is distinguished professor of tobacco control at the University of California, San Francisco. He's on the line. Professor Glantz, welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Professor, where do you think tobacco is headed in the U.S.? It seems to me it's going the road of alcohol and maybe even marijuana, where it's sequestered in very, very specialized locations, both for sale and use.
Oh, there's no question that that's happening. We're well on our way to meeting former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop's vision of a smoke-free society. For example, here in California, the adult smoking rate is down to about 11%. Kids are in single digits, and the people who are still smoking aren't even smoking every day. In fact, I think that if we were to really crank up the state's tobacco control program to where it used to be, we could essentially eliminate tobacco as a public health problem in 3 to 5 years. And I think if the Obama administration pursued similar policies, we could eliminate it in maybe 8 to 10 years in the whole country.
So then what does that mean in business terms if the business, the tobacco business, the Philip Morris's of the world, remain and make all of their money everywhere but the United States?
Well, there's no question that the tobacco companies are aggressively expanding overseas, and there's actually a large trade agreement the Obama administration's been aggressively pursuing called the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's going to help the tobacco companies in their overseas expansion and could even help them fight tobacco control regulations here in the United States. And I would hope that President Obama would take a lead from CVS and really unleash the FDA, let them ban menthol, let them start moving to aggressively regulate e-cigarettes, and that the states would restore funding to their tobacco control programs and get out there with the kind of aggressive media that we know works. You know, interestingly, though, when you're lead-in, the movies remain a huge problem. Movies are the major place that kids get media, pro-tobacco media exposure right now. And while it looked like the big studios were getting smoking out of their youth-rated films back in 2010, there's been a big rebound in recent years. And we've been working to get the movie smoking integrated into the rating system. And we think an R rating for smoking, which would get it out of the youth-rated films, would save about 1 million lives among current teenagers today.
Well, an indication that we are sort of all over the map, even given the CVS decision on where tobacco fits in the U.S. economy and culture and popular culture. We will continue to grow tobacco to sell to places overseas, even if we become a smoke-free society. Stanton Glantz, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Stanton Glantz is a medical professor at the University of California, San Francisco, where he specializes in tobacco control. Let's look for a moment at the tobacco industry's loyal, addicted market.
This is Rosie Martinez from Austin, Texas. I get my cigarettes at CVS or Walgreens because they have the cheapest prices. I recently started trying e-cigarettes, but have not converted 100% yet.
My name is Ben from Salem, Oregon. I rarely smoke, but when I do, I'll buy my cigarettes from a mini-mart.
Diana says the writing has been on the wall for CVS for a while. Cigarette sales have been on the decline for years, she writes, and CVS, as well as many other retailers, have taken an ever-increasing hit in profit as a result. This is not altruism. It's basic common-sense business, but you can bet they will market the heck out of their goodwill for the public. I am a smoker, one of you in Austin, Texas writes. I get my cigarettes at Walgreens. If CVS's goal is to be known as a place which promotes health, are they going to take inventory of the many other products they sell that are not healthy? Are we on a slippery slope here? Do soda, beer, and candy get a new look? Probably not, but that's a good question there from Austin. And it's a question that the president has apparently thought about. President Obama, the ex-smoker, said in a statement yesterday, as one of the largest retailers and pharmacies in America, CVS Caremark sets a powerful example, and today's decision will help advance my administration's efforts to reduce tobacco-related deaths, cancer, and heart disease, as well as bring down health care costs, ultimately saving lives and protecting untold numbers of families from pain and heartbreak for years to come. Now we can all breathe a little easier and our families can live healthier. That's from Michelle Obama, who also praised the CVS decision. Bill Gates tweeted, "Thank you, CVS. You've made a bold move and set a great example." Billionaires love this move, apparently. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg said, who changed the smoking culture in New York, by the way, that CVS sets a new bar for all companies that market themselves as pharmacies and healthcare centers. If you're a smoker, where do you get your cigarettes? If you quit, when and how did you do it? From Oklahoma, I buy my tobacco from gas stations or smoke shops, but I mainly use e-cigarettes and enjoy the healthy alternative. My husband uses only e-cigarettes after 15 years of smoking and no longer has asthma or sleep apnea. You know, my own brother is in that category. Here's a good one. I get my organic American spirits from a locally owned convenience store. Can you tell I'm from Portland, Oregon? From Alexandria, Louisiana. I'm a 39-year-old smoker, been smoking since I was 13. Back then, one could buy a pack of smokes for $1.25. Now, almost $5 a pack, depending on where one lives. Could be as high as $7 or $8. I usually try to buy my cigarettes by the carton because it's cheaper. And normally, Murphy USA, the gas station at most Walmart stores, has the cheapest price on cartons. $38 in Louisiana, $50 in Arkansas. I'm in Indiana right now for work, so I will find out today how much they are here. Well, thanks for doing the legwork for us and drive safely out there. And here's where the CVS decision doesn't really matter.
Hi, this is Janelle from Sarasota. And as any true and honest diehard smoker will tell you, you've got to get them when you can, where you can, while you can.
This is Michael from San Antonio, Texas. When I was a smoker, I got my cigarettes at the gas station, like any other irresponsible person that smoked in the first place. I never bought my cigarettes from a pharmacy. That would have been less expensive and less convenient. I also, the way that I quit was the only way that I've ever been able to quit anything, and that's by actually deciding to do it, and that was cold turkey for me.
This is Jennifer from Virginia, and I quit smoking in March 2010. I had my wisdom teeth removed, and the doctor told me that smoking would prolong the healing process, so I obeyed doctor's orders and I haven't smoked since.
Some more quitting stories. Here's one of you in Hawaii. 5 years ago, my wife and I decided we were ready to be parents. We were told that if we wanted to increase the chances of conception, we needed to make some lifestyle changes. Amongst them, diet and exercise. I was also told that nicotine inhibited the mobility of sperm, so I quit smoking. Been thinking about it for a few years anyway, so that's what I did. Cold turkey. I had tried before, so I knew what I was in for, so it made it easier. Now, 4 years later, I wouldn't trade one day of my daughter's 4 years for a single cigarette. Give us your view at 877-8MYTAKE. You can weigh in at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Coming up, the Olympic Winter Games kick off tomorrow. We'll be giving you a guide to the city of Sochi, and we'll listen to some of the music of Russia. That's in just a moment.
Puff, 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 puff your cares away.
The only thing I want to experience is winning a gold medal.
Sitting on the slopes of potential history.
We hit up to 6G forces.
Well, the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
If you can't race yourself, you can't race anybody else.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
Forget all the Olympic sports for a moment. The skaters and skis, curling stones and bobsleds. For all of its current troubles mounting the games, the icy wonderland of Sochi, the Black Sea coast and the Caucasus region, is at the center of some of the richest history of the past 500 years. These forthcoming Olympic contests pale in comparison to the battles won and lost, the empires that clashed, and the prizes seized down through history in the Caucasus. And in the epic competition for this region, Russia got the gold medal in the end. For Charles King, professor of international affairs and government at Georgetown University and author of the book The Ghost of Freedom, A History of the Caucasus, Sochi is a window on one of the world's great historical narratives.
The Caucasus was historically a kind of meeting place of empires. It was the place where the Ottoman Empire, the Persian Empire, and the Russian Empire came together. And over the course of the 18th and 19th centuries, really from Peter the Great all the way up through the end of the 19th century, this was a zone of contestation between these three major powers. Russia ended up the winner and ended up controlling the entirety of the Caucasus zone, that is the area north of the Caucasus Mountains and the area south of the Caucasus Mountains.
And what about the Black Sea? What is the significance of the Black Sea? There was always talk during the Cold War that the Russians never had a warm water port and that the Black Sea didn't suffice, but that didn't stop the Black Sea from being an important place for Russians.
Exactly right. The Black Sea itself was a kind of mini Mediterranean. It too was a kind of fracture zone between different imperial powers or between different nation states. By the end of the 18th century, the Russians had come to control most of the northern and eastern portions of the Black Sea, including the area around Sochi, but it remained a kind of fault line during the Cold War. To the south, you had Turkey, which was a member of NATO and the Western Alliance, and around most of the rest of the Black Sea, of course, you had the Warsaw Pact, including the Soviet Union.
Going back to Catherine the Great, now, you know, my history's a little fuzzy here, but I'm counting on you to fill in the details. Is it the case that Catherine the Great launched one of the greatest sort of naval debacles in the history of the universe in the Black Sea against Turkey?
Well, there were a number of very, very difficult naval encounters on the Black Sea throughout history, in fact. The Black Sea has a sort of strange quality to it. Below about 200 meters or so, it's completely dead. So the theory is that, in fact, every ship that ever sank in the Black Sea, every wooden ship is down there somewhere. There aren't any microorganisms that can eat the wood. So it's a very interesting body of water. But in the late 18th century, in one of Catherine's wars, there was a terrible battle that took place on the opposite side of the sea from Sochi, that in fact a very important American took part in it, John Paul Jones.
I remember, yes, he was kind of the hero of that.
He was one of the heroes. He was the a person who, at that stage, having beaten the British in the American Revolution, sold his talents as a sailor to another power, Catherine's Russia, and stood off against the Turks in that battle. He was later on hounded out of the Russian Navy and died a pauper in Paris, and then was later dug up and became an American hero.
So if you're going to the Sochi Olympics, there's no way you can find any John Paul Jones memorabilia anywhere.
No, alas, he didn't leave the Russian Empire in particularly good form, but it's an interesting connection between the United States and that part of the world.
The city itself, Sochi, what significance does it have? Is it a place where, Russian oligarchs and royalty had their dachas, or is it more of a working class, humble city?
Well, Sochi is a rather small city. Now, it's swollen over the last couple of years with the incredible construction that's gone on there and in the outskirts of the city and farther south along the Black Sea coast, where most of the Olympic events will actually take place. But in the Tsarist period, Sochi became a very important resort. The city itself had existed before the Russians came there. An indigenous group called the Circassians had built small settlements around Sochi and other parts of the Black Sea coast. But it became a kind of Russian Riviera, if you like, the place you would go for your summer holidays. And it became that as well during the Soviet period. It was sometimes called part of the Red Riviera, the place where communist bosses and average Soviet citizens would go to enjoy the water in summer and the mountains in winter.
You know, the Russians and the Americans share a questionable legacy in the sense that we don't have a terrifically wonderful record in dealing with indigenous people in our lands. So whether we're talking about Native Americans here or the way the Russians treated people in the Caucasus all the way through to Siberia when they conquered Siberia, will there be any sense of the people who once lived in these lands, or is it completely overrun by modernity?
Well, I think, of course, the groups that we're talking about who were there before the Russians arrived were indigenous, but perhaps not in the way that word, with the connotations that word has sort of in English. This was a very well-developed local Muslim, literate in many cases, society that progressively was overrun and pushed out, expelled, by the Russians as they conquered the Caucasus in the 19th century. So many activists, I think, today are looking to see whether that local culture, which still exists in the North Caucasus, is recognized in the opening ceremonies or what have you. People look at the Vancouver Olympics, for example, when the First Nations of Canada were the official hosts and were the first people to appear in the opening ceremonies. And the question is going to be whether the Russians acknowledge that local culture or not.
Favorite event at the Games that you'll be watching?
The luge. You know, that's the kind of thing that I think is an absolutely insane sport, but you cannot take your eyes off it.
You got kind of a crazy wild side there, Charles King.
Well, you know, the Caucasus itself is a pretty wild place. And what I hope is that some of that local, bizarre and interesting culture, which is, you know, Russian but Muslim, Highlander, seafaring, but also mountaineers. It's an amazing mix of different kind of cultural traits. And what I'm hoping is that Russia will acknowledge that side, not just the onion domes and the Kremlin and Red Square, but this other bit of Russia that's equally fascinating.
Charles King, professor of international affairs and government at Georgetown University, author of the book The Ghost of Freedom, A History of the Caucasus. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
Classic Russian orchestral anthems, beautiful, perhaps sometimes a bit ponderous and dark, will be on exhibition at the Winter Games, this famous piece from Mussorgsky included. But the Sochi Games will be more than just a chance to simply revisit the Russian war horses. It will also be a chance to discover the relatively unknown underground pop music of a Russia that has lived two solid decades of radical change. The program Soundcheck, which airs on our partner station WNYC, has been talking to interesting and dialed-in Russians and Russian-Americans about the music of their homeland we can discover during the Games. Their series running this entire week is called From Russia with Soundcheck. John Schaefer, our Bob Costas of the musical world, host of Soundcheck, is here to share some Russian gems to go with your frozen shots and hot borscht. John, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be here, John.
So I suppose Putin will probably rely on the classic war horses of Russian classical music to
there are certainly enough of them.
Theme his Olympics. But for Russians and Russian Americans who are looking at the games and thinking about Sochi, there are all kinds of musical options that are happening very much today.
And this is what we've been doing on Soundcheck all this week, is trying to get some kind of a handle on the variety of Russian popular music. And a lot of it existed underground during the Soviet years and, you know, distributed on handmade cassettes and dictaphone recordings. So there's a Disney world of great music that most Westerners have never heard.
So what's the first cut?
Well, there's a band that keeps coming up in our conversations with Russian editors and writers, and they're called Leningrad, and they're from the city of St. Petersburg, which was formerly Leningrad. If you're familiar with the American band Gogol Bordello, this kind of gypsy punk band, Leningrad is Russia's version of Gogol Bordello.
These guys go back a ways. There's a little Tom Waits in there, too.
Yeah. They're fun, and they are considered to be one of the two or three biggest rock bands in Russia today.
What do you got next?
Well, for me, the big discovery of this week of delving into Russian music has been a band called Grazhdanskaya Oborona.
Grazhdanskaya Oborona.
Which means civil defense.
Learn something new every day.
Yeah. This is a band that was led by the late Igor Lietov, who died in 2007. They came of age in the 80s. They were kind of the first flowering of Russian punk. And just discovering this guy's music has been, for me, a real eye-opener.
I can't imagine there's any irony in the title, Everything is Going According to Plan. Little Dylan in there, maybe some Cobain.
A little Cobain, possibly a little Joe Strummer, maybe some Billy Bragg. The punk lineage is deep in this guy.
But he's no longer with us. But
no
his
longer
music
with us.
Is still very influential.
And the song Everything is Going According to Plan is, as you suspect, a very ironic title, and was created during the period of the Soviet Union. This is pre-1991.
And, very much in the 90s, there was a look back at the excesses of the Soviet Union, the use of Leningrad, civil defense, all very, very relevant to those years. Anything beginning to get beyond those sets of images?
Well, you know, it's funny. We talked with the Russian editor of GQ Russia, a guy named Michael Idov, who lived here in New York for many years. And he shared a track with us from a band called Kino. The song is called Next to Me, and the way he described it was, this is something that could only have been created in two times and places in human history, either Russia, 1985, or Williamsburg, Brooklyn in 2007.
The culture of jolly hipsters. It's global. It's global.
And apparently, Brooklyn-style hipster culture has become hugely popular in Moscow recently. Although, as Michael Idov of GQ Russia was telling us, not so much the music. It's the skinny jeans, the big frame glasses, the artisanal food, all of that kind of stuff. And very popular with the young Russians.
Plenty of places in Brooklyn where you can go to Russian grocery stores and hear only Russian spoken, and much more today than there was even 10, 15 years ago. So you also chose people to be your guide in some of these musical selections.
Right. Well, we're very lucky that, as you say, there are a lot more Russian speakers here in New York than there were even a generation ago, and many of them are creative, artistic types. And among the people that we spoke to was the singer-songwriter Regina Spektor, who grew up in the Soviet Union. She was born in 1980 and left in 1989, so some of her formative musical experiences were in the Soviet Union, and she told us about one of the so-called bards, the singer-songwriters, the guys with guitars, who were so important on the Soviet music scene back in the 1970s.
It's all about this guy who falls in love with this woman at a party, but then gets a warning from the guy who was with her before. And he doesn't heed it. But there's like this refrain of like the one who was with her before.
Ты тот, кто раньше с ней был. Он мне грубил, он мне грозил, а я все помню. Я был не пьяный. Когда ж я уходить решил, она сказала, не спеши, она сказала, не спеши.
Now that's Vladimir Vysotsky. And he's often compared to Dylan, but I'm hearing Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, there's a little of that. Vladimir Vysotsky was one of these people who did house concerts, and each time he played a concert, a cassette would be made, and these things would circulate like wildfire throughout the old Soviet Union. So even though this was kind of her parents' generation, Regina Spektor grew up listening to and loving the music of this singer-songwriter, Vladimir Vysotsky.
Now, I'm, in fact, writer Gary Steingart's biggest fan, and I can't figure out if he's, like, excited about the Sochi Olympics or terrified about the Sochi Olympics. You connected with him.
Well, you know, he has this new memoir out called Little Failure.
Yeah, which is unbelievable.
It's predictably hilarious.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we asked him to bring in some music that meant something to him when he was a kid growing up in the old Soviet Union. And to our surprise, his list of songs included something very, very familiar to Western listeners.
What a great song for somebody who's preparing to leave Soviet Russia for, you know, for the United States with its sort of turbo capitalism. You know, it was perfect. I mean, I think every immigrant to America should get an MP3 recording of Money, Money.
Money, 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 must be funny in the rich man's world.
You know, I bet Vladimir Putin even has this on his playlist.
This is, you know, again, part of that cassette underground culture would be Western songs. And Gary also told us that when he first heard this ABBA song, he's not sure it was really ABBA. It might have been a local band covering this ABBA song, or it might just have been a cassette of a cassette of a cassette.
Well, that's how underground culture works.
That's how underground culture works. Money, well, money, money.
And it'll be very much out of the underground when the Sochi Olympics begins, but great soundtrack options for us. John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck on our partner station WNYC. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
We're lucky to have John Schaefer back with us again tomorrow to discuss the 50th anniversary of the Beatles arriving on the shores of the USA. We'll leave you with the conversation the CVS pharmacy has started about smoking with its announced ban on tobacco products.
This is Victor from San Antonio, Texas. As far as I'm concerned, smoking is bad. Lost my dad to lung cancer in the 60s. It's a crappy way to go.
Keep them coming. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.